If you'll turn to your Bibles to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. That's where we'll begin tonight. I want to thank you for this opportunity that you've given me. It's a real honor. And I think that this whole week of lectureships by young men like me is a really, really cool idea. And I think it gives the young men opportunity to get a chance to preach and to meet some people that they never have, like I am here, and see Christians from a different part of the world, make connections, which is always very cool. But I think it's also great for y'all because you get to see basically the future of the church. And you get to see young men who are taking active part and spreading gospel, to see what they're doing in their lives and how they're living lives of godliness, and just like was mentioned in the opening remarks. And I think that could be very beneficial for a congregation as well. So hopefully you will get something out of this lesson as well. A little time ago, I was reading through the story of Joseph. And the story of Joseph, it's pretty famous, even if maybe this is your first time walking in a church building, you've probably heard something about Joseph before. And it starts in Genesis chapter 37. And if you read through Genesis chapter 37, it talks about how Joseph had a bunch of dreams, but his father really favored him and gave him a coat of many colors that we teach our children when they're little to sing the coat of many colors. I will not sing it. And then how the brothers were jealous, and so they throw Joseph into a pit and then sell him to some Ishmaelites, and then he's sold to Egypt. And that's the end of chapter 37. And then in chapter 39, you pick back up with him in slavery at Potiphar's house. And then it continues the rest of the story. But chapter 38 is really interesting. You think, why did God put this here? It seems to just be split in the middle between in Joseph's story. Like, did he not have another place to put it? What is going on? I don't think that's the case. In fact, I think God is actually telling two stories here, and they're connected. He's telling the story of Joseph, one of a man who tried to serve God but came against some really hard circumstances. And the other one is the story of Judah, who constantly tried to fight against God. And it didn't go well for him very well. And I think a lot of times we pay attention to the story of Joseph because it's nice, it's clean. But the story of Judah is not. It's kind of icky. It's kind of disgusting. It's not what we want to talk about. There's not going to be many plays done on it. There's not going to be many children's Bible stories that will cover it. But I think Judah's story has an equally powerful message. And it deserves as much time as Joseph's story. And so if you will tonight, we'll cover the story of Judah. The story of Judah starts in chapter 37. Chapter 37, starting in verse 25. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hands be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. Now, if you want to stop there, when I was a little kid, I used to think Judah was kind of he did a merciful thing. I mean, like, selling somebody to slavery is not as bad as killing him, right? And that's not the case. Judah is not doing something for the benefit of Joseph. He does not care about Joseph and whatnot. He kind of hates him. Instead, he's looking out for his own gain. He's saying, well, instead of killing him, let's sell him, at least get some money off of it. And actually, this was a crime that even in the law of Moses was punishable by death. If you sold another human being into slavery, you could be killed for that. That was the punishment. So this is a big thing. And Judah is the person lenient. And if you look through Genesis and when it deals with the sons of Jacob, Judah is mainly the leader. He's the one that goes out and is the leader of the 12 sons. And in this case, he leads them. And so since he was the leader and the one that suggested, he's probably the one who said it. If not, he was in the room down in verse 31. Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered it, a goat, and dipped it, the robe, in blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And of course, he identifies it as Joseph's son. And he says, "My son, my son." And he cries for days. And he cannot stop crying. And none of his sons, none of his daughters, none of his wives can comfort him, because he's grieving the loss of his son Joseph. Then we come to chapter 38. Chapter 38, and verse 1. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Many commentators, many people have speculated, why did Judah leave his brothers and go out on his own? Some speculate that maybe the herds were getting too big. Some think maybe there was some disagreement that came up. Maybe they were fighting over whose land to do, something like Abraham Lot did, whose herds got what land. This is my suggestion, but I think it has merit to why he did it. If you look at the end of chapter 37, what is it talking about? It's talking about Jacob's grief. How every night he's just not getting over it. He's mourning his son. And every night Judah has to listen to Jacob's cries and mourning and see his haggard look and see him in loincloths and just miserable. And day by day, Judah's guilt increases. And more and more. Until finally he can't stand it. When people are guilty, they can do one of two things. One, they can fess up. They can say, "I have committed this wrong. I want to make it right. I will do what it means to make it right. I'm sorry." That's one option. And if Judah went and did that to his father and maybe tried to go to Egypt, try to save Joseph, there would be nothing else in chapter 38, and we may not even read it. He could have saved himself all the heartache that's going to come. But there's a second option. And the second option is to run away from what is making you feel guilty. And so he does. He departs. He goes by himself to a different area that is not surrounded by his father or by his brothers, things that remind him of what he's done. Instead, he surrounds himself by somebody of the land, Hira the Adullamite, who we'll find out is not a very good friend. He won't prick Judah's conscience. He won't make him feel bad. And that's how he chose. Verse 2. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and conceived and bore a son, and called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chizdeb when she bore him. When you read the story, and if you've been a Christian very long, let me ask this question. When a God-fearing man, an Israelite, goes and marries somebody of the land, a Canaanite, how does that story usually end? Is it good? They had a lot of kids, and they went off and lived happily ever after? Or does it turn bad? And the rest of the story is despair and disappointment and destruction and sin. Like 98% of the time, it's the latter one. And it's no different there. Because if you keep reading, in verse 6 it says, "And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of the brother-in-law to her. Raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew his offspring would not be his own. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he wasted the semen on the ground, so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah's son grows up, for he feared that he would die, like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. So what was the consequences of him going off and marrying a foreign woman? Well, his oldest was wicked. Was wicked. So God killed him. And then Judah said to Onan the second, go perform your brotherly duty. Go take your brother's wife. And this was done a couple of reasons. This was a normal practice in the day. It was actually a practice that was commanded in the law of Moses. I think Deuteronomy 22, I want to say. 20:22. And it was done for two purposes. One, it was to provide for the brother's wife, in this case Tamar, because women in that day didn't have a lot of ways to self-sustain themselves. They didn't have a way to provide for themselves. It just wasn't feasible in that day as much. And the second way was to create a legacy, inheritance, so that his brother's name would not die out and he would have children. The reason Onan doesn't want to do this, though, is one, he would have to provide for Tamar and whatever child he bore her. They would consume his resources, his money, his food, and he would have to provide for them. But second, if he bore a son for his brother, they got part of his inheritance. So if he bore a son for him with his wife and bore a son with, in this case, Tamar, they would have equal parts of the inheritance. And so the greater portion of his money and his wealth that he's accumulated, part of it would go to somebody who was not really his son, somebody who would not carry on his name, would not carry on his legacy. So that's why Onan refused to bear a son. He was greedy. And what he wanted was the pleasure without the consequences, without the sacrifice, without the commitment. And I say that's the same thing that people do today. Onan wanted the pleasure of having sexual relations with his brother's wife, but he didn't want to give up his money. He didn't want to give up his wealth. And people do that all the time today. People want the pleasures that come with sexual relations, but when they have a baby, they want to abort it because they don't want to take on the responsibility. When things get too hard in the family, many times fathers or mothers will just flee the family and get out because they can't handle it. They don't want the responsibility of their actions. Many times people want the grace and love of Jesus, but don't want the commandments and obedience that it takes to follow. This world is filled with people who want pleasure without responsibility. It's no different from back then. Because we, as humans, have been struggling through the same things ever since the Garden of Eden. We continue the story in verse 12. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah, to his sheep shearers, and he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to shear sheep, she took off her women's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself and sat at the entrance of Enah, which is on the road to Timnah. For when she saw that Shelah was grown up and she had not been given to him in marriage, then Judah saw her, and he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, "Your signet, your cord, and your staff that is in your hand." And so he gave them to her. It went into her, and she conceived by him. Then he arose and went away. Taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. So Shiloh's grown up. Judah had no intention of giving him to Tamar, because he was thinking, well, she's been with my first son, and he died, and then with my second son, he died. I'm definitely not giving this woman to my third son. She's a bad luck charm. Even though she had nothing to do with why they died. They're wicked in God's eyes. And Tamar was seeing this. And so she took it in her own hands. And I think this is a powerful point. Because throughout the book of Genesis, we see when men aren't stepping up, when they aren't leaders of their house, when they just don't do what is right, and don't lead according to God's way, not man's way. Because Judah's been doing it according to his way. But do it according to God's way. When men aren't like that, it gives the temptation to the women to take it in their own hands and do something wrong with it. We saw this with Adam and Eve, where Adam wasn't the strong spiritual leader. When the devil came up and tried to tempt Eve, Adam was not like, no, we're not going that way. He just went along. When Sarah came to Abraham and said, well, maybe it's through Hagar that we're supposed to give this promise. He was like, no, we need to trust in God. We need to trust in him that he can do it through you even though you're old. And said, no, we're following his way. And if Judah had done what he should have done, something that God killed Onan for, and said, I will give Shelah to you, he could have avoided a lot of this that was about to happen. But he didn't. So he was passive. He didn't do what God said. And so what she does is she goes up to where she knows he's going to be, and puts on the clothes of a prostitute. That's the veil. Prostitutes wore veils in that day. And he sees her and is overcome with sin and desire and lust, and asks, what will it take for me to come into you? And notice what she says. She says three things. I want a pledge. I want your signet. I want your cord, and I want your staff. All three have to do with identifications. One signet, one's cord, and one staff was unique to that person. But also, they represented three different things. Your signet represented who you are, your family seal. Later on, kings would have it in their rings, and it would be a crest, a decree to send out, saying, this is mine. So it's your primary way of identification. Your cord represented your honor. So your identification, your identity was hung on your honor. And your staff, it's power. It's extension of your arm. It's what you can use to fight away people or wolves or whatnot. It's power. She takes all three from him. She takes his identity. She takes his honor. She takes his power. And whenever we sin, whenever we turn our back on God, when we go in and say, we'll trade. We want this sinful thing. We give up our identity. We give up our honor. We give up our power. Because we were slaves to sin. And slaves don't have identity, honor, or power. We cannot be gods and in sin. There's a saying that I've kind of heard growing up, that sin will take you farther than you want to go, keep you longer than you want to stay. It costs more than you want to pay. No one has ever made that trade-off and said, yeah, I'm glad I did that. I'm glad that I gave away my honor and my identity and my power for that sin. I'm glad I did that. No one's done that. You can look through the Bible, and story after story after story, there's people, godly people, who made that trade-off, said, I want this sin, I want the desire, I want that instant gratification, and paid for it dearly. for the rest of their lives in some cases. Don't make that decision. It's not worth it. It never is worth it. And the story continues in verse 20. When Judah saw that the young goat sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And when he asked the men of the place, "Where is the cult prostitute who is at Ena at the roadside?" they said, "No cult prostitute has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her." Also the men of the place say, "No cult prostitute has been here." And Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, or we should be laughed at. You see, I sent this goat, and you did not find her." Notice what Judah does. He blames his friend. And wouldn't this be a good time to have a good friend in this instance? Because Hira the Adullamite was with Judah when he was bartering with Tamar. He could have been like, "No, you don't need to do this. This is not you. God would not approve for this." If Hira said that, maybe he could have saved his friend from doing something evil. But no, in fact, he's helping him pay off. And we've heard it often that bad company corrupts good morals. And I would add, bad company makes bad morals even worse. And that's what has happened here. Hira's not the kind of friend you want. Hira's not the kind of friend that would keep you out of sin. And that's why we need to pick our friends and who we hang out with very, very carefully. And what Judah does is, after Hira comes back and says, "I can't find this cold prostitute. I can't find her. No one says they've seen this." What does Judah do? He blames Hira. He says, "We're becoming a laughingstock because you can't find this prostitute." Is it really Hira's fault, though? It's his own. He made the decision. He decided to go into Tamar. He's again pushing blame onto someone else. He's not taking responsibility for his actions. So this all comes to a culmination. This is the climax. In verse 24, it says, "About 3 months later, Judah was told, 'Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she's pregnant by immorality.' And Judah said, 'Bring her out. Let her be burned.' And as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, 'By the man in whom these things belong, I am pregnant.' And she said, 'Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.' Then Judah identified them and said, 'She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son.' And he did not know her again." I want you to picture this. Judah is sitting in his tent or under a tree, and somebody from the village, maybe a local gossip, comes in and says, "Hey, you know your daughter-in-law Tamar? She's been sexually immoral. And in fact, she's pregnant." And you can just see the rage that comes across Judah. It's like, "I can't believe that she would disrespect me. I can't believe that she would disrespect my family." Not totally hypocritical to what he just did a few verses ago, 3 months ago. He's just indignant. And then she sends his cord and his signet and his staff and said, "Please identify who these are." See, Tamar was sly. She knew that this day would come and Judah would want to cause harm to her. But as he sees those things, he gets hit with his own sin. And he can no longer deny. He can no longer run away. He can no longer blame someone else. He had sinned. And it wasn't only his sin with sleeping with his daughter-in-law. It was also his sin not giving Sheila to Tamar. And not only was it those two sins, I want you to look at the language here. In the latter half of verse 25, it says, please identify who these are. And then if you look back in chapter 37, in verse 32, says, please identify whether this is your son's robe. Very similar language. It's even closer in the Hebrew. He's hit with that language. He's reminded of what he did to Joseph. He's hit with what he did to Tamar. He's hit with what he done to Tamar and not giving Sheila, and what he did to Joseph. All at once. And he cannot hide. He cannot run. What is his options? He decides to turn. And it's this instant that Judah's story flips. This is where he turns. And this is how I know it. If you want to fast forward to Genesis chapter 44. Genesis chapter 44. This is after Joseph had been sent to Egypt. He's been raised up to second command. And the brothers have came in, asked for food, and they said, and Joseph said, I'll know your story is true and you're not spies if you bring back your youngest son. So they bring back the youngest son because they need more food, and this is the second time they've been to in front of Joseph. And he sends them away with their sacks very full, but he sends his royal guards out to capture them and says, why have you repaid evil with good? One of you took my master's cup, and they found it in the sack of Benjamin's. And Joseph is about to take Benjamin away and keep him there at the palace. But Judah speaks up and says, can I have a word with you? And he recounts things from his half. And we'll pick up in verse 30. Verse 30 of chapter 44. Now therefore, as soon as I come to your servant my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up with the boy's life, as soon as he sees the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring it back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father and all my life. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy, as a servant to my lord. Let the boy go back to his brothers. For how can I go back to the father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father. So far, what have we seen in Judah? We've seen nothing but selfishness. Nothing but think about himself. Back in chapter 37, when he comes up to seize Joseph, and he sees him in pit, and he sells him to the Ishmaelites. Was he thinking about how Joseph and how scared his little brother was and how much he's going to have to endure if he sells him slavery? No, he was thinking about his own profit, his own gain, his own jealousy. When he revealed and lied to his father about selling Joseph away and says that he's dead, was he thinking about his father and the sorrow that would come across? No, he was thinking about his own gain and how he couldn't reveal that to his father. Was he thinking about his family when he went to a foreign country that was not around people who were godlike and how that would impact his family? No, he was thinking, I have to escape this guilt. I have to get away. Was he thinking about Tamar and his brother and his deceased son, and carrying on his lineage when he didn't give Sheila to Tamar? No, he's thinking, I just can't lose my own lineage. I need to keep my lineage long. I need somebody to inherit my name. Was he thinking about his own, was he thinking about Tamar when he came on Tamar and she was dressed like a cult prostitute and God and what he was not supposed to do? No, he was overcome by his own lust and his own desires and his own thinking. Even when Tamar comes to him and somebody says Tamar has been sexually immoral. Does he think, well, I've done that too. Maybe I'll pass it off. Maybe she slipped up. No, he's thinking, how can you disgrace this family? Over and over and over and over again, Judah has thought about nothing else but himself and the impact decisions made on himself and how he's supposed to feel good and get the pleasures of the world until this point. And he gets up and Joseph says, I'm taking Benjamin. The rest of you can go. And Judah, thinking that Benjamin had taken the cup, he didn't know that Joseph planned it, says, no, let me take his place. I know he did wrong. I know he did something that he wasn't supposed to. I know he stole. But let me take the blame. Let me take the punishment. Let me take his place, his position. He's changed. He's no longer thinking about himself and how he would never see his family again, how he'd spend the rest of his days as a slave or sitting in some prison. He's thinking about his son Benjamin, or his brother Benjamin, how he'd take it. And he's especially thinking about his father. What impact was his father be under if he came back? What would it do to him if he came back without Benjamin? And he had love. He had compassion. And he offered to take his brother's place. And that was the very act that broke Joseph down. That act of love, that change, was what broke Joseph down and says, I'm actually your brother. That's the story of Judah. It's one of a man who fought against God, but became a story of redemption. I want to leave you 3 points. One, there's 2 paths to God. And what I mean by that is there's 1 path that tries to do God's will, that goes on it and tries to obey everything that God commanded. Try to do what right and live by honor. Doesn't mean they don't hit a few bumps. It doesn't mean they don't stumble sometimes. But they tried to do what is right. That's kind of the story of Joseph. He hit some pitfalls, but he tried to do what is right. Then there's some whose path to God is rocky, and they're kicking and screaming all the way. They don't want to serve God, but God's just nudging them. Little things through his life, consequences, little actions, trying to get him back. And it's a testament to God's grace. At any point, God could say, I've had enough with you, Judah. You're dead just like your son, Ur and Onan. But he had grace. And he saw something good. He saw potential there. So he kept trying to correct him, trying to discipline him. Both ended up doing right, being the people that they're supposed to be. But I tell you what, Joseph was 10 times happier in slavery and prison and knowing that he was doing right by God than Judah ever was, living on his own and living his own life. If you're doing wrong and you're thinking, hey, at the very last instant, I'll just turn back, don't do that. You never know. You may be like Ur or Onan, and tonight it could be your last night, and God will strike you dead. And 2, it is so much better to be right with God, to know you have a clean conscience, to know that you are right with God, and that if you die tonight, you'll be all the better for it. Instead of trying to struggle, you fight against God. And that kind of leads to my second point. There's always hope. I don't know many of y'all personally, but if you're like me, the people I know, you have family. You have very close friends who are not Christians, who are not living right. And you've told them over and over, and they refuse. Or maybe they lived a Christian life, they were Christians, and they turned away. Don't give up hope. they can still turn. Pray for them. Love them. Love is the most powerful act you can do for someone who's not in God's love, not under God's salvation. There's always hope that eventually one thing will happen that'll be enough to turn him around. And then finally, God can turn the worst things into good. This is a dirty story. This is not a great story. This is not one that we want to read most times. This is one that is very ugly. But God turned it good. And not only in turning it to good through turning Judah back and becoming and make him right with him and changing him. He also did it through another way. If you had the choice, who would you pick to be the great, 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 great grandfather of Jesus? Joseph or Judah? I would think Joseph. He like practically like him almost. But instead, God chose Judah. It wasn't even through his proper marriage, like through Sheila. It was through this act with Tamar. And Tamar had a son named Perez. And through him, God saved all humanity through Jesus. And was able to forgive all sins, including his great-great-grandfather's Judah. And in Revelation, he is named, Jesus is named as the Lion of Judah. That is the story of Judah. Maybe you're here tonight and you see a lot of similarities with you and how Judah was. You're living a life that is your own, that is not according to God's. You can make that right tonight. And you can go home knowing that you have a clean conscience and you're right before God. And that is the best feeling in the world. I hope you'll do that tonight as we stand, as we sing.